Welcome to Soulful Streaming. I'm Tina.
And I'm Allie. And we are connecting you with the wisest souls to help you build a deeper connection with your mind, body, and soul.
So let's get to it. Welcome to Soulful Streaming. We have a really, really special show for everyone today. And then we're going to do a little bit of a different format. We're actually going to break this conversation into two parts, mainly because the guest that we have on is super special to both Allie and I. So for Allie and I, instead of your normal bio stuff, we're going to share with our listeners who you are for us. So with us today, we have Steph Jagger, who is an author, a coach, a space holder, and maybe even somewhat of a modern mystic. So Allie and I have been passing Steph's books around, both of her books, which we have with us right here, Mind, Felon, and Ocean. We'll talk about that later. And we also had the great pleasure of working with Steph for her program called The Great Big Journey. So we've graduated from that program. And this interview that we're going to have today, it's essentially going to be kind of a book club. So consider yourselves a fly in the wall of a great conversation with three women about some really, really awesome and amazing topics. So
welcome, Steph.
Oh, I am so thrilled, happy, honored, delighted, and excited to be here. And also, what an unbelievable, like, for me to be able to get to work with people is well more than enough. Like, that is, I love my work. It's a beautiful experience. To be inside of, in a tangible way, something that burst forth from their imaginations in some beautiful co-creation, and here we are sitting in the actual reality of it, is just an absolute gift and blessing. And I feel so lucky and grateful to have been able to witness even more than what I get to witness in our individual sessions. So I feel really privileged to be here.
Thank you.
Feeling mutual.
That means a lot. We love a full circle moment.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
It's the best.
This will be fun. So before we jump into all the deep questions, we have some light and fun questions to ask you. It's a little bit of a lightning round so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. So what's one thing, Steph, that people would be surprised to know about you?
I think people would be surprised to know the like depth and vastness of my humor. Like a lot of my life is lived in like deep laughter. I really believe in taking things seriously and examining our lives and, you know, all of the elements of like our own personal healing. And I feel like laughter is holy and it's a tool to move through our lives. So I think especially people who follow on Instagram and people who have read my second book, Everything Left to Remember, I think they would find that surprising maybe. I don't know.
Laughter is holy. That's pretty cool. It really can be.
It is.
Yeah.
So for the folks who are listening in but not on camera with us, I see some massive trees behind you, Steph. You live in a forest, near a forest, in the middle of it, right?
Ooh, I do.
What's the best thing about living in a forest?
The best thing about living in a forest is the access to silent wisdom. Like there's knowledge and wisdom and information around, underneath, in the air all the time. But it doesn't come with noise.
Yeah. Another Stephism, and we're only 2 minutes in. introvert or extrovert?
I think I'm right in the middle. I think I'm in the middle. Okay. I think the younger version of me, I mean, I did in Unbound, in my first book, I described myself as a flaming extrovert. I think really what that was a lot of people pleasing. And my kind of validation was received from kind of external places. And so I felt I had to be maybe an extrovert to get that. And as I've shifted my validation from external to internal, I've noticed myself moving along the kind of pendulum more over to a a hermited forest dwelling introvert, but I still do love being around people. So it's, I think it's a bit of a blend.
There's nothing wrong with that, right? So say you're having a party and you get to pick three people dead or alive to come to your party. Who are those people?
Oh my gosh, this is so hard for me because there's a lot. I think I'll answer this by saying Jesus for sure. Like, I would like to, especially in this day and age, I'd really like to pick the brain of Jesus. And if he was going to be there, then I also feel like I would want Mary and Magdalene to join. Like, I want the women, I want the generational women also at the table. So those would be my three right now. But like, you could ask me tomorrow and I'd be like, Joseph Campbell, Terry Tempest Williams, Barry Lopez. You know, like, I don't know. But those are my three today.
That's okay. Great. That would be a fascinating party to go to. You guys can take a nice walk and
yeah,
just have great conversations.
Yeah, I'd be like, Jesus, tell me.
Let's ponder this. How do you know that you're in a state of flow?
How do I know when I'm in a state of flow? Two things. Number one would be there's a distinct sensation in my body that I can feel. And the way I might try and put words to that is there's a timelessness. I've moved outside of linear time.
That's like a common theme we've heard from folks, and yeah, obviously in different like words, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a guest on that said that they forget to drink water, which mm-hmm. to me, you know, is exactly like, you know, time is no longer linear. Mm-hmm. I love that. We call state of flow soulful streaming, which is obviously the name of the pod, but I love your answer. So we're going to put you a little bit on the spot because, you know, Allie and I would say quite well, given the work we've done together. So could you bless us with three words that describe each of our energies? How would you describe us? We're putting you on the spot.
It is. It's so on the spot. And, you know, I was thinking about this and I thought, oh, like how uncoached, like this is not like my, it's always you are the guru of you, you know? But I actually think that there's this beautiful like blending place for both of you that I don't know whether I would like push it out into individual, but if I think about the two of you together, there's this first and foremost shared like spark. I don't know whether that's a word to describe, but you both have an inner flame that you are seemingly very driven by, which is gorgeous and beautiful. I think you both, I would describe you as extraordinarily curious people. And I love that. And I think that's one of the reasons that you've both been driven to work with me and to do this podcast and to have these conversations. And I would also add in, I find the two of you to be very like smart. And what I mean by that is like this beautiful combination of an ability to use your intellectual self and combine that with a physical and emotional wisdom that together is what I think of as like, oh, that's a smart ass woman. That is a smart woman. And I think of both of you as that. So those are my three.
That is so kind.
I love that.
If we ever need a reference, we might call you.
Yeah.
No, but it's awesome. I mean, the shared spark, I've never heard that before. But that's totally us, you know?
Yeah.
When we were doing the pod in the early days, like, I had to tell my husband, like, I am not having an affair with Allie. We are really doing a podcast because we were together all the time. You know?
Yeah. In a way.
Thank you for playing that little lightning round. That was fun.
So, yeah. So Steph, your most recent memoir, I'm hugging it right now. It's just like, oh, it's become a part of me. And I don't have words to describe it, but something that came into mind, and this is actually the title of another book, but it's like when breath becomes air, like there's just this alchemy to these pages that happens. And in the dedication to your book, you wrote, "To my mother, the way you revealed yourself in the midst of your disappearance has taught me more than the sun, the moon, and the swing of the ocean between them. Good God, how you've set us all free." There's a few themes that really stood out to me in the book. But the two that had the greatest impact to me as a reader were the following: love languages and intimacy in its many forms. So we often consider love languages in our romantic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
The aha moment for me in reading your book was, gosh, I really have never analyzed or taken time to think about the love languages of my parents and the love languages in, as you describe, the constellations of a family.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up in a blended family. I have like 16 Christmases. It's just too much. It's a lot. So, you know, there's these different styles. And I, you know, grew up as a child, I was always the observer, right? Because there's just so much to take in, right? And I would say, like, my mom's side of the family, they make amazing volunteers. They're always there to drop off soup if you're feeling sick. Their love language style, I would say, is acts of service, right? My stepdad's side of the family, and my mom's going to argue this, what you hear is this, but they're more like the lovers. Like, they're going to give you a hug. They're going to, you know, more words of affirmation. So, and then my dad's side of the family, they're a little bit more to themselves. They're a little bit more of a mystery to me. But I had something happen to me recently, and I believe I shared this with you, where my dad spent some time in the Orient when he was in Vietnam. And he has these paintings that he did on silk. And they're very Oriental. And somehow one of my uncles, they were moving, and there was this painting that he had gifted them a while ago that he made. And it was of these beautiful tiger lilies. And I just had this moment after reading your book, and I said, and I just was like, man, maybe gifts are his love language. And it just was this moment of true understanding. And, you know, I think this is a complicated thing to navigate still when you grew up maybe learning one love language style and you form a love language of your own. So, you know, you mentioned in the book that an element in your personal love language is words. And I was hoping you could fill us in a little bit about this process for you and your mother, which is so much in the pages of this book.
Yeah. I mean, so my primary love language, if we're going to use that distinction or way of describing things, would be words of praise. So if after this, you could tell me that I did a good job, that would be wonderful. and my mother is and was not a person who used a lot of words, right? Yeah. And so there is a, as you said, like kind of this mismatch there. Now, as we step into adulthood, as we move through reparenting, and as we take kind of radical responsibility for ourselves as we move on and mature, I think it's really important for us to reflect on the love languages around us. First and foremost, to ask, and I think this is a predominant question I ended up asking in the book, is if I gained a greater fluency in my mother's love language, what is available to me? What might I be able to be in receivership of love-wise that I've blocked off, I haven't seen, I have dismissed, I have, you know, et cetera. And so that's certainly one part of it. Like the example with your dad and the painting, the silk painting is so beautiful because the question there for me would be, how can I be in receivership of this and read into the energy of love that this piece of silk is like imbued with, right? That doesn't answer the question of, or the examination of, I still have a predominant love language and some of my needs need to be met in that way. And so as a person who is taking responsibility for myself and potentially moving through a reparenting process of some of the love I may have missed because there was quote unquote language barriers, how do I give that to myself? How do I, you know, for me, it's become really important to ask myself how I am speaking to myself. If words of praise are a big part of my own love language. How, as an adult woman and as a person who's been moving through remothering and reparenting, what is the voice of love that I'm committed to using with myself? And so it's a both and for me, you know, how do we step into a fuller degree of receivership and gain a little bit more fluency in the language of other people, not just our parents, not just our partners, et cetera. And also, how do we utilize the tool of our own love language to gain a deeper degree of intimacy and knowledge of self and encouragement to self and love of self?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I was inspired when you wrote about that you had to learn a more subtle language as your mother's ability to recall memory lessons. You talked about how one of the ways you were able to maintain closeness with her was maybe not necessarily through spoken language, but more in the subtle, more in the mundane. And my husband and I are in a season of aging parents as well. And, you know, I had an experience with my father-in-law where, you know, I personally, throughout my fertility journey, I felt more like a patient than a person. And I had this moment with him since he's been seeking medical attention and seeking answers for his symptoms. I had this moment where, you know, I shared with him all of the needles that I had to use throughout my IVF journey. And we just had this shared moment of compassion for each other. And, you know, I loved some of the pages of your book, how you guys just had these subtle moments, or just even being side by side. And I just am curious how your definition of intimacy has changed and shifted since this journey you took with your mother.
Yeah, certainly it has shifted because of the journey that I took with her. It's also shifted because of what I've learned by way of my husband, who's really involved in the trauma and the nervous system. Field. So it's been kind of a combined wisdom there. One of the biggest things that I've learned in the Alzheimer's and dementia community and the experience with my mother is that a lot of us rely on shared memory to connect with our loved ones and our relatives because we share a memory of, you know, dad trying to burn down the house, or maybe not trying to, but almost burning down the house at the barbecue in 1987. You know, we can reflect upon that memory and we can laugh and we feel connected to each other in that moment.
Right.
Or even the idea that they still remember my name means that we're connected. Right. And so that is certainly a part of how we maintain a connection with other people, but it's not the only part. You know, one of the biggest things goes to exactly what you said, Ellie, this kind of what are the more subtle or even sometimes silent languages that are happening, or communication that's happening between people. And so much of that for me is presence-based and sense-based. And this is where it blends into what I've come to learn of as a definition of intimacy, specifically from the trauma and the nervous system field. So all of us have been in different conversations about this, but for listeners, how I would define that is intimacy is our ability to be in proximity to, so close to, another thing, a person, a place, a part of ourselves, etc., in proximity to another thing, feeling ourselves as we feel them. Okay. A lot of people think intimacy, especially women, think intimacy is to be in proximity to something and just to feel all of them and then adapt who we are and what we are around what we're feeling they are. Right. And That's like enabling, that's feeling other people's feelings for them. That's a whole bunch of different things, right? So to be in proximity to my mother and to feel myself, to feel my body, to feel my heartbeat, to feel my temperature, to feel curiosity, to feel nervousness as I'm sitting next to her on a bench in front of Old Faithful at Yellowstone National Park. So to feel myself and then to feel her and to feel that she's also experiencing nervousness or, you know, butterflies in her stomach, or just to sense into that. That is a profound form of human connection that, and maybe she's feeling something different as well, but that idea that I could just be sitting next to another human being, feeling myself, I feel happy, I feel relaxed, I feel nervous, I feel tense, and then tuning into with some kind of energetic boundaries, what are they feeling? And being able to pick up on both of those things at the same time is just, it's a profound form of human connection. And to me, that's the definition of intimacy.
Yeah.
I can feel myself feeling you, and you can feel yourself feeling me. Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably pretty hard to get to that place of understanding what you just explained, like embodying it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It
probably doesn't
come very naturally. Of course. There's it is. Like, you know, it's easy to kind of go like, okay, that's an intellectual, I can intellectually understand that definition. And then to do the work to get to the place where we can feel it for many of us is, first of all, never mind sharing space with anybody else, can I feel myself feeling my anger, say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead of just feeling my anger, letting it take over, except, you know, can I feel myself feeling my nervousness or my anxiety or my happiness or my joy, etc. So the practice for me really started with, can I have intimacy before I even attempt to do this with other people? Can I do this with myself? Can I be in proximity to the range of different sensations and emotions that I can feel in my own body and have that relationship be that definition of intimacy, feeling myself, feeling them at the same time? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you, are there any hacks you can give anybody? I mean, was this something you worked on with your therapist, or is this something that you just kind of intuitively picked up on?
Yeah. So the biggest hack, we want to call it that. So the biggest hack is that it's not a hack. I mean, this is long term. Yeah. There's no quick way in. And in fact, you know, the definition of trauma, of nervous system dysregulation, is too much, too fast, too soon.
Yeah.
Right. So the idea of having there be a hack to this is just kind of counter all of the work that's done in the trauma and the nervous system and re-embodiment landscape. This is very slow. The only kind of hack that I can think of is how was my nervous system built, mirrored off of the nervous system of my primary caregivers. So if my primary caregivers had a relatively regulated nervous system, if they were okay feeling themselves undulate inside of their nervous system as I was a two-year-old having a tantrum, then I probably have a fairly regulated nervous system.
Yeah.
So the hack is really found in that primary caregiver relationship. I happen to have had parents who had relatively regulated nervous systems. So I would say what I've got is like nervous system privilege, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That I can more readily and kind of my emotional, physical, somatic landscape has doorways that open more easily and regulation that happens more fluidly because of that nurturing that I got as a little one.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the work is like very slow, titrated kind of re-embodiment that, yes, has happened with somatic therapists and in relationship. It is, this work is primarily done in relationship, either in relationship to self, but also deeply done in relationship with other people.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that. I was just going to say, this is a theme we've heard on as we're talking to people, talking to my therapist too. It's just in a place of safety and security, you can really tap into some of these deeper layers. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I want to read a page from my favorite chapter.
Yay.
And then we'll chat about it a little bit if that's okay with you.
I love that.
Is it awkward to hear other people reading your book to you?
No, it actually, there's a feeling of relief of like, oh, I'm just going to sit back and
okay.
I'm going to receive. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So receive it. Okay. So my favorite chapter is my mother tongue.
Mm.
So I'm reading from page 219. Things were being said in the language all around us. Stories coming in on the wings of the birds, on the wind, on the river as it cut arcs through the sand on the banks. It seemed there was a whispered narrative coming in on the heartbeats of the animals walking through the brush, on the scent of pine as it warmed in the morning sun,
wisdom was pouring in on the wordlessness around us, not by way of technical descriptions or the statistics of the area, but on the gaps in between. It came in on the spaces. It hung, like I had all my life, on the things not said. I watched my mother catch wisdom with her body. So, after I read your book, a few things happened. I immediately went on Expedia and started looking up flights to go and see the Grand Tetons and Grand Teton National Park and Yellowstone. It's going to happen someday, hopefully with my future daughter or my future son.
Yeah.
And also, I grabbed my journal and I was so inspired and I started writing. I started a small blog. So I saw you, I think, about a week after. I just needed like this total debrief. And we had an interesting conversation. It was a conversation that surprised, I think, the both of us. And I made a revelation to you that you received with so much grace. I told you that I realized something about myself and this relationship that we've had. So I would say it was it's a coaching relationship, but to me, it feels like more. And I realized that I was drawn to you and your work, and it was coming from a place of one big old projection. What I mean by that is I was admiring you from afar. I was admiring your writing, and I came to you from the pages of your first book, Unbound. And I also came to you by way of hearing you on a podcast. And I just realized that not only you, but these other authors that I was consuming, what I was surrounding myself around on social media. And I realized that I had a desire to write. I had a desire to live into my creative expression. And you and people like Suman Kidd, I was sort of putting on this little pedestal. Because it was something that I admired and desired in my own life. So, you know, I noticed there was, you know, a theme that you use with some of your clients and in the work of The Great Big Journey, which is your signature program. So you you ask a lot of your clients to give a list of people that you admire. Three, I think you ask for three. And, you know, this is a coaching tool.
Yes.
Because what you're attracted to, you're also trying to bring in. And so I wanted you to explain, one, why this is a great coaching tool. And also, there was some projections within the pages of your book. And I wanted you to kind of describe, if you can, you know, how you learned throughout the course of this journey that maybe it wasn't so much about learning more about your mother or trying to extract some knowledge from your mother as her memory is lessening, but, you know, instead about maybe finding something in yourself.
Absolutely. I think this is such a beautiful topic, and I'm so glad that you've brought it up, Allie. And I, you know, this is when we use the term and think of the term projection, most of the time we're thinking about like the bullshit, right? Like don't project your bullshit on me. Like that's your unprocessed stuff. And you know, you're calling me selfish because you're actually selfish and can't come to terms with it or whatever. Yeah. So we do that and we project our quote unquote shadow, right? We see this a lot in society. We also see, and this is one of the reasons that I've woven this, you're exactly right. It's in the first week, in the prep week of The Great Big Journey, I've woven this in, is that we project our gold. Okay. So the things that we have that we're right on the cusp of taking ownership, the things that we're looking to call in, the things that we maybe have in abundance and could step into like lickety split, but maybe we've been shamed for them in the past, or told that part of ourselves isn't valuable or worthy, or that our voice isn't strong, or, you know, those types of things. What we tend to do is look around and see people in society, friends, family, famous people, etc. And we go, that person has it. Like, I admire them. I'd like to be like them. I'd like to, you know, engage with their work, etc. which is all good. But that's one of the reasons that I ask it as a first question when I'm initially engaging with someone in a coaching or mentorship relationship, because it gives me an idea of what this person is on the cusp of themselves, even if they don't quite see it yet. Like, oh, I could never be, I mean, I'd sit here and go like, I could never be Sue Monk Kidd. And you kind of go, well, what about her is it that you're drawn to? And the right. reason I ask usually for 3-4 people is because it's never usually about one person, right?
Right.
If it's about one person, that's kind of idolization or it forms kind of an illusion. But when I see a list of 3 or 4 people and I'm able to kind of pull a thread through, like there's something that runs through all 3 or 4 of these people, and I'm making this scenario up, that suggests you are on a kind of cusp or breakthrough of creativity.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think it's a really, really beautiful thing for us to examine where might be or who might we be projecting our gold onto. And how do we use that as a first step in recognizing the direction we might be moving in ourselves?
Right.
There's a secondary part of that, which is exactly that. Like, how do we use it as a step into ourselves, as opposed to that person separate, I could never be, they're going to have to hold this. Like, that's a lot to then say, okay, Sue Monk Kidd, you're going to have to hold my gold. You're going to have to hold your gold, and you're going to have to hold my gold for the rest of time and eternity, because I haven't figured out a way to do this. To instead go, oh, she can hold her gold. It's so fucking beautiful. It's going to serve as a source of inspiration for me. And let me bring out my journal and start writing and exploring and looking at that threshold and that cusp, right? Gorgeous. Yeah. What you said in regards to what was my experience on the trip with my mom, you know, there was kind of an egoic projection of like, I, you know, I'm here to help her. Like, this is, you know, I wonder if she's going to ask her, you know, energetically or otherwise, for me to like assist her in some way, like thinking like,
yeah,
because there's nothing I need assistance with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's nothing about myself I need to discover, you know?
Right.
And so I was really kind of going for her, like, what, you know, I want her to give me her story. You know, that was a projection. I wanted myself to give me my story.
Yeah.
You know, and of course there's a fluid and blended space in between, because I think, you know, mothers and daughters have like very intertwined and braided stories. Mm-hmm. But I think that was the beginning of that kind of projection. Like, oh, actually what I'm after here are the places inside of myself that I've locked away, that I need to learn how to trespass through those and claim them as mine. Yeah. This isn't about me getting access to my mother's story. Like, that's for her. That's her sacred space.
Right.
This is about me getting access to mine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And thank you for explaining that, because it definitely was an aha moment for me that, oh, projection isn't necessarily a therapy term. It can be, it doesn't always have to be shadow, right?
That's right. Yeah.
That's awesome.
By the way, Reese Witherspoon was on both of our lists.
Yeah. I think I remember that. Yeah. I mean, gosh, yeah. You know, so I think she should maybe be on everyone's list.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, speaking of, just sorry, coachy moment, like the three things that I described in each of you at the beginning that were like this blended thing that I see in both of you, like, hi, I kind of see that in Reese too. I mean, I don't know Reese personally, but
yeah. She just keeps like, the universe just keeps like pushing her towards us.
Reese and Sue Monk, we would love to have you.
Thank you for listening to the first half of our discussion with Steph Jagger about her most recent memoir, Everything Left to Remember. Please know that it's available anywhere. We will drop the links in our show notes, and we are going to allow for a little marination, and we will be back with the second half of our discussion in a couple of days.
In our second half of the discussion, you can expect to learn a little bit more about what it is that Steph does. Tina's going to dive into a little bit more about her first memoir, Unbound. This is such a great story. Steph skied around the world and she quit her job and she made some big discoveries about herself. So we can't wait for you to hear about it and dive a little deeper and learn a little bit more about Steph. Please know that her books are available on audio, on Audible, wherever you get your audiobooks. They are available in independent bookstores. They are available online on Amazon. Please go pick one up. You won't regret it. And please share it with your mother. And we will be back soon. Thank you.
Hi, listeners. It's Allie. Thank you for streaming with us today. If you enjoyed the show and want to show your support, please leave a review, subscribe to get notifications on new episodes, or share it with your loved ones on your preferred social media outlet. If you are not sure how, please reach out to us on Instagram at Soulful Streaming, and we are happy to help. Please enjoy this instrumental piece inspired by the show, written and recorded by Aubrey Mabel. Until next time, this is Soulful Streaming.